This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know them, you love them, and they want to eat you. You never know when a zombie's going to show up. Never know. And they are, of course, the living dead. Unholy corpses rising from the grave to eat human flesh. The staple of horror movies and Halloween. You're going to see them tonight. People dressed up. Ordinary people dressed as zombies. The brain-eating, decayed creatures of the big screen have infected popular culture. But the origin of the living dead has its roots in the Caribbean nation of Haiti. Lorraine Dubois joins us now. He's a professor of history and romance studies at Duke University and co-director of the Haiti Lab at Duke's Franklin Humanities Institute. Lorraine, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the zombie in Haitian culture. And is that the zombie? Is that actually the forerunner of the zombie that we know today?
Well, it is in a way, although there's several steps to go to before we get to American popular culture. I mean, the zombie is in fact within Haiti a relatively marginal social phenomenon, right? This is a thing that is very hard to track. A few people have tried finding examples and so forth. But as in our culture, it's much bigger as a kind of symbolic terrain, you know, and the sort of stories about zombification and the idea of zombification is very, very important in Haiti, as it has become in the United States. And it is from Haiti that the kind of first representations of zombies came to the U.S.
And what is the zombie in that culture? I mean, tell us about the place that it holds in the voodoo religion, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea of the zombie essentially is a slave in some ways. The zombie is a kind of ultimate victim, the zombie of someone who is controlled by someone else, who doesn't have the capacity to act on their own. And again, in the culture, there's this sense, there is a long-running sense that in some secret societies or others, there might be people who are able to turn people into zombies through poison and so forth. Wade Davis, an ethnobotanist, studied this famously in the last couple of decades. But people talk about zombies a lot more than they see them, right? And I think that's kind of the key.
What was the zombie created in Haiti? Does it go back to West Africa?
There are West and Central African traditions it probably drew on, but it clearly became a much more powerful symbol in a nation which had experienced a very brutal, brutal form of slavery and then had risen up against that slavery and created independence. So I would say that the reason the zombie is so powerful in Haiti is precisely because Haitians know that they kind of got rid of slavery, but there's always an anxiety that one might be kind of re-enslaved or re-subjected to external forces.
And this is a kind of interesting difference between the zombie in Haitian culture and the one in American popular culture, which is that the zombie in the voodoo religion is the ultimate victim. They're not looking, they're not scaring us. They're they're the victim.
Absolutely. And someone who zombified someone else would be considered, as doing a kind of rather evil thing within voodoo itself, right? So it's looked as a kind of marginal phenomenon within the religion itself.
Now, I've seen some discussion about the fact that in that slave culture, particularly the harsh slave culture under French occupation in Haiti, one of the worst crimes would be suicide. You've destroyed my property by committing suicide. Right. Was this in any way used by slaveholders, the idea that you might not make it to the other side, you might not really be dead, to sort of persuade people not to kill themselves?
It's possible. I mean, again, there's sort of sense what developed in Haitian voodoo was a sense that when you died, you returned to Africa. And you kind of – that was a way in some ways of going back, of ending the exile of New World slavery. And so, yes, maybe the idea that you could never truly die, that you would be kept here, could serve as a kind of threat.
So tell us now about Wade Davis. You mentioned him, and he's somebody who was looking into the kind of ethno-botanical origins of zombieism.
He did. He went down to the Caribbean, and actually he intersected and he worked closely with a number of Haitian scholars and some Haitian voodoo priests who were interested in the phenomenon as well. And what he argued in his book was that in certain secret societies in rural Haiti, this might have been used at times as a kind of form of punishment. And he sought and thought and kind of argued that he had found some of the poisons that were used, which would essentially kind of render someone seemingly dead when they were in fact still alive.
Yeah, so they could, they still had sort of mechanical movement, but not control of their will. Mm-hmm. And again, as you suggest, this goes back to the ultimate anxiety in a slave state that has gained its independence, but surrounded by hostile territory, including the United States of America at the time, which was not at all thrilled by free slaves.
Right, absolutely. And I think there's an old, that's a key connection. And in fact, in our own culture, the kind of origin origin, the place where the zombie begins to arrive in U.S. culture is during the U.S. occupation of Haiti. And that's no accident, because the U.S. occupation of Haiti did stir up great anxiety in the country, that the United States had come essentially to kind of re-enslave people. And it emerges in the context of new plantations, new plantation system being built, people losing their land and so forth. That's, you know, that's a time when people talk more about zombies because of anxieties in the culture.
Kind of interesting that we know more about zombies than we know about the American occupation of Haiti, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways one has replaced the other in our imaginary, and that's a loss, right? Because the reason that the zombie is so powerful as a symbol is because it's a way of people to think about and worry about a kind of alienation that certain forms of labor and power do affect.
Yeah, but and look at the difference in the way the zombie is perceived. In Haitian culture, it's the victim. Here, mm-hmm. we're victimized by the one who we've made a victim. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate fear. Right?
Right.
Once you make slaves of people, what are they going to do to me for doing that? Mm-hmm.
And that changes, of course, because actually the first zombie film, which is The White Zombie, which emerges in during the time of this U.S. occupation, those zombies are victims, right? And in fact, in that movie, they're literally they've turned into zombies so that they can make sugar cane. The story of that film comes from an account of an American visitor who heard stories about zombies being talked about with regards to HASCO, which was a Haitian American sugar corporation, a U.S. Haitian company that was trying to reinstill sugar production, which of course was the old colonial plantation production. And in that context, locals began to say that some of those who worked in that factory were actually zombies. He heard that story, wrote about it. It made its way to Broadway and eventually to U.S. film.
And remind us again when this occupation took place here in the 20th century.
Right. That starts in 1915 and goes to 1934. And it's by the late 20s that these stories begin circulating.
So Wade Davis was a scholar, ethnobotanist. He mm-hmm. goes over and he thinks or he claims to have found – by the way, was that ever verified? Are these neurotoxins? Has anybody gone back and said, oh, yeah, that's exactly what that'll do for it, too?
There's still a lot of debate about his work, both among biologists and among Haitianists. And of course, Wade Davis wrote a very scholarly book about this, and then he wrote a narrative about his trip called The Serpent and Rainbow, which was then turned into a horror film, a popular horror film. So his story has been taken up in a lot of formats.
All right. Well, let's hear a little bit from the film The Serpent and the Rainbow.
I couldn't get my mind off the zombie, Christoph. Why would they do such a thing to him? Why would they make anybody a zombie?
Christoph is more than just a patient to you, right? You knew him from somewhere before.
No, but I knew of him. He was just a grade school teacher, no one important. But he wasn't afraid to speak out for the people, for freedom.
He was very much admired. That's why they made him what he is. Instead of inspiring courage, now he only inspires fear.
So now we have the zombie as an overtly political character or mm-hmm. plot line. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course, in the 20th century under Duvalier and other contexts, I mean, the zombie has also been a way of thinking about politics and talking about politics, and as it is in some ways in our own popular culture too. So,
how is the today in Haiti? What is the place of the zombie in how are they perceived, and what influence has American culture had on that perception mm-hmm. in Haiti?
Well, I think a double thing. I mean, to some extent, I think many Haitians will downplay it, and I think rightly in some ways, you know, as basically pointing out that voodoo is mostly a religion of healing. It's not about witchcraft. It's not about these things. And that this is, again, a kind of a marginal phenomenon, and that to project it on the whole religion is a mistake. So in some ways that's affected it. But of course, the kind of idea, the general idea of this fear, I think still circulates and is part of the lore and the culture.
Interesting too, I think you've said that there are stories of people having direct contact with zombies are rare. So unlike, you know, stories that we have of alien abduction and other things where people claim to have had mm-hmm. initial, you know, an immediate contact, that doesn't seem to be how the zombie story is transmitted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, sometimes people will say, you know, that they had seen somebody or but again, the talk around it is much greater. And when Wade Davis himself went, I mean, it was very tough to find verified examples of this, right, when you really started to look at it.
But a lot of people claim to have known somebody who knew somebody.
Right.
So it
yeah.
wasn't as though yeah. they were distancing themselves for it or that they didn't necessarily believe mm-hmm. it. It's just that they hadn't had
yeah.
initial
yeah.
contact.
Yeah, and Lanek Urbon, who's a leading Haitian ethnographer, I mean, what he's written about has shown that there are sort of periods in which zombie stories circulate more in Haiti and others that have to do with kind of political conflicts or social issues. And so that's the kind of key, I think, is understanding that this is a way of often talking about other things. It's more than anything else.
When do zombie stories become more popular, more current?
I mean, sometimes it's around anxieties, around a kind of loss of control. So again, the U.S. occupation seems to be a time. There are a period in the late 19th century where U.S. power is kind of more and more present in Haiti. And then over the course of, for instance, the Duvalier regime and the kind of there's also a kind of just sense that under a certain kind of dictatorial rule, a population can kind of be zombified, you know, can lose the capacity to have the free will that they should have.
We are talking about zombie folklore and zombie popular culture today. Lauren Dubois is with us, professor of history and romance studies at Duke University and co-director of the Haiti Lab at Duke's Franklin Humanities Institute. Just ahead, zombies in the movies and literature on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about zombies today, the living dead, traditional tropes of horror narrative. With us in the studio, Lauren Dubois, a professor of history and romance studies at Duke, co-director of the Haiti Lab at Duke's Franklin Humanities Institute. Joining us now to talk about the influence of zombies in literature and film, Maria Promajori is head of North Carolina State University's Film Studies Program, and Richard Dansky is a game writer for Ubisoft, and he is also a horror novelist. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard, let me start with you. We think of zombies in the movies, of course. They're a real staple in films, but is there much zombie literature out there in print?
Oh, absolutely. There's a ton of zombie literature. And it's in really all levels of literature at this point. There's young adult zombie literature, Jonathan Mayberry's novels like Rotten Ruin. You've got sort of postmodern zombie literature that you're getting in novels like Myra Grant's Feed, in the anthologies like 21st Century Dead by Christopher Golden. At this point, the trope has spread beyond the very narrow boundaries of the sort of classic zombie apocalypse.
How far back does it go in literature? Is it a relatively recent phenomenon or?
The first mention of the word zombie in English language literature is 1929, The Magic Island, which was written by a guy who was actually a bit of a cannibal himself. But the sort of modern...
a bit of a cannibal?
He did, in fact, try human flesh. His name was Seabrook, and there was one verified account, and then supposedly he claimed to have tried various other cuts of meat, shall we say.
Okay. And he writes this novel.
Yeah, that was more
1929,
more the traditional Caribbean zombie. The modern zombie horde stuff really sort of starts with Richard Matheson's I Am Legend, which was an inspiration for George Romero's zombie films, and it picks up from there.
Is there, Lauren Dubois, do you think, is there a genealogy in the literature? Certainly 1929, it sounds like they're mm-hmm. writing it.
Well, this text by Seabrook, The Magic Isle, is really the key pivot, right? Because that's what brings a lot of this kind of lore to the attention of American readers. It's a very popular book in the United States, a strikingly illustrated book. I mean, it's a fascinating book to go back and look at. But some of these stories of zombie, as I said, come out of his visit around the Haskell Plantation and so forth. So he's really at the origin of a lot of this stuff.
And that's also the basis for I Walked with a Zombie, mm-hmm. the Jacques Turner film from 1943. It was actually that novel. There was a supposed first-person account published mm-hmm. in a magazine, but it was actually from the novel you're discussing that was the basis for I Walked with a Zombie, which seems to be, as we were talking about earlier, the kind of tail end of the overt zombie tales that deal with colonialism in the Caribbean or around the world. Mm-hmm. There's another film, Revolt of the Zombies in 1936, that relocates the zombie myth to Cambodia for some reason, but mm-hmm. exoticized, obviously, colonial space. And as Richard's pointing out, by the 60s, and particularly Night of the Living Dead, the colonialist implications have really changed, have mm-hmm. really shifted in terms of the way we see the zombie figure.
So in those first films in the early part of the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, zombies weren't so terrifying as they were the victims.
Right. They're exactly as Laurent was describing them. They are exploited labor. They're working in sugar mills mm-hmm. in the Caribbean. That's exactly what they're looked at. And that labor theme reoccurs again and again in more recent zombie lore.
I would just say one thing about Seabrook is he's in Haiti at a time when the U.S. is actually repressing voodoo. Voodoo is actually illegal during the U.S. occupation. So he actually has a lot of hard time finding informants, but then he kind of dresses that up. So he kind of presents himself as a real authority, though he was there at a time when people really didn't want to talk to him much because actually you couldn't really admit to practicing this religion under the military occupation.
So then we do get to Night of the Living Dead, and that is the film that, sort of a lot of us remember as the quintessential zombie film. Although interesting, this is 1968, this film comes out. Although interestingly enough, they're they're never called zombies in the film, right?
No, Romero really thought of them as ghouls, not zombies, and sort of popular culture slapped that term onto it, and he embraced it ultimately because that's where the popular zeitgeist was going. But a lot of the tropes of the modern zombie, the, you know, the shorthand that we all know now, the brain eating and the, you know, killing by shooting the head, that all got tacked on later and later and later. The brain eating didn't happen until, I think, Return of the Living Dead, which was in the 80s, one of those standard horror comedies that came out around that time, like Night of the Comet. And the stuff has just been accreted onto what was originally sort of a consumerist critique that Romero put out there.
Yeah, but the key here is that while they weren't considered zombies at the time, they were scary creatures. They were going to hurt you or out to hurt you. They were a little slow, but they could hurt you.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So when did they start becoming zombies, Maria? How did that connection get made?
I mean, they're understood as zombies in the sense that, again, going back to Laurent pointing out, when you are essentially a functioning body without a soul, I mean, that's actually what Zora Neale Hurston, also a writer and ethnographer, described as a zombie. So whether they're called a zombie or not, technically, in the 1968 film, I think they are understood as the living dead, the walking dead, as we have in the AMC series. And I actually think it's interesting in Shaun of the Dead, there's a scene, and I think you may have a clip from that, where Shaun actually says they shouldn't be called zombies. And I actually wonder if that's a throwback and a reference to the fact that Romero had not, in fact, labeled them as zombies,
well,
but as ghouls.
Let's listen to a clip now from Shaun of the Dead.
I can see it's just outside.
Any zombies out there?
Don't say that. That.
What?
That. The Z word. Don't say it.
Why not?
Because it's ridiculous.
All right. Are there any out there, though?
Can't see any. Maybe it's not as bad as all that. Oh, no, there they are.
Oh, there they are. So that's interesting. I mean, at one level, it seems almost self-referential. It's like, we're not going to do a zombie film. But what is going on by this time? By the time Shaun of the Dead comes out, when?
2004.
2004. So what do you suppose is happening there? Is that a spoof on the zombie film? Have we already gotten past doing a straight zombie film?
Well, and you've already discussed the fact that zombies reflect certain social anxieties. And you have in the 60s with Night of the Living Dead some very specific anxieties, the Vietnam War, civil rights that are very clearly marked in that film. And I think by 2002 is when you get 28 Days Later, which is a sort of serious attempt to revive the zombie genre. And Shaun of the Dead is obviously bringing in humor, which we've already seen in the horror film genre and films like Scream, the highly self-referential aspect of that. But I also think some of the tropes remain. So, for example, we're talking about exploited labor. Shaun of the Dead is very much about the economic concerns of globalization, of a world in which Shaun, the main character, essentially works at a kind of Best Buy store. At the end of the film, zombies are now employed to sort of do things like gather up the shopping carts in the parking lot. I mean, doing the jobs that people are doing that makes them feel like their souls are being sucked from their bodies. So you still have that critique. I mean, Romero is really the one who brought in using zombies as social satire, and his films look at different things. As we were talking about with Night of the Living Dead, the Vietnam War, and so the next film looks at consumerism, the one that's set in the mall, and that's the one that's remade in 2002. So the zombies are horrifying figures who do all of these horrific things and eat brains and drool and stagger. At the same time, they're being flexibly employed and reemployed to look at different aspects of culture. And I would say the last decade, it's primarily about violence and the video games in particular, and economics. You know, so we have terms like the zombie bank and the zombie corporation that come out of the savings and loan crisis of the 80s, the Japanese economy of the early 90s. So these are banks that have no money, but they're still functioning.
And the consumerism, too. You mentioned how consumerism makes its way in. I mean, was that any part of Night of the Living Dead? Again, a sense that we're blind consumers, we're not paying any attention to. Or does that really happen by the 21st century?
I think that's been in the DNA of the sort of Romero horde zombie all along. I mean, if you look at it, it's a creature of the faceless, ravening horde. There is no identity. You get infected, you become one of it, you lose yourself. And if that seems like sort of an emo trope, well, yeah, it really is. You're fighting against being absorbed into the faceless mass of being just like everybody else. And that has been built into the DNA of the stuff since, you know, you're fighting zombies in a Pittsburgh shopping mall.
Mm-hmm. What about the hero, in a sense, I Am Legend? Does that change the picture a little bit? Do we – the traditional hero narrative is changed in that – move up just a little bit closer, if you would. Yeah, do we get a kind of sea change in our focus and the nature of the hero in the zombie flick?
Well, the hero in I Am Legend, you know, that's a sort of Twilight Zone twist that came out of those. You know, that was the sort of narrative that the writers in that California school were all doing. At the end, oh my God, realize the hero is actually the monster to all of these other creatures, and that, you know, it was a great ending for that one element, but for the longest time, it was really about the survivors and what made you so special that you were a survivor, that you survived when everybody else didn't, what made you unique and interesting and talented and deserving to survive in the face of this sort of faceless horde. And it's not until really the last few years that we've gotten wider work in a more interesting space where it's about the conflicts and the normal people put in this extraordinary circumstance again.
But it's a great example of creative destruction. It's like, oh, you're being destroyed. Oh, but on the other hand, maybe that's the way Darwin intended it. And so if you're surviving this horrible plague, maybe that's the good thing because you came through it and you're now perhaps resistant to the next wave of whatever it is.
Well, and I think that's right. And I think the zombie, as Richard and I were talking about before, is so mutable, and you know, we use the term viral, but it can be inserted in or used in so many different genres. So, for example, you look at AMC's Walking Dead, that's really Stagecoach with zombies, right? It is about a sort of diverse survivor culture that needs to protect itself in all sorts of ways. And so there are heroes and villains within, you know, the governor is protecting this group clustered in behind these barricaded walls. And even Romero's last film, The Land of the Dead, which he specifically connects to problems with politics in the Bush administration. I mean, it's essentially about real estate magnates. It's about real estate. That's why it's called Land of the Dead, and it's about the 1%, and those are not necessarily the heroic survivors in the same way that they're presented in some of the other zombie films.
Interesting, isn't it, Loren, that in the layers and the texture in American culture, both this fear of being victimized by those you've made victim, mm-hmm. and then you layer on top of that your own anxieties about being victimized by, you know, people at the top. It's a real kind of, you know, being caught in the middle.
Yeah, I think it's powerful in that sense. And, you know, there are ways in which it still remains kind of regionalized or even localized, right? So that although in the earliest movies it's the Caribbean, it's not always. In Serpent and the Rainbow, it becomes once again Haiti as the site of the zombie. But so part of the question is, where do zombies come from and what creates them? And I do think, and you know, what's interesting is that Haiti is kind of always there to some extent in people's minds, but also at times, of course, it can become very, very distant from that. And the forms of critique, like I know Occupy Wall Street, for instance, you know, they dressed up as zombies and went into malls on Black Friday and so forth. So the idea that the zombie is a critique of consumerism does link to this, the idea that the zombie is a critique of slavery, right, in some deep way.
Yeah, and there's a, you know, sort of popular economic theories that talk about zombie economics, that our souls have become detached from our bodies, so our bodies go out on Wall Street and get it money any way they can, and then we go and donate to, oh, say, NPR.
Right.
To assuage our 1-800-9. I'm not going to do that.
But to assuage your
nice
conscience,
try.
So your brain is somewhere else, right? And your body is out there, you know, just sucking up the brains and mm-hmm. doing whatever it can to stay alive or moving.
And that form of consumption is ultimately, as this genre tells us, or as the zombie tells us, cannibalistic, right? So anything, the overconsumption ultimately comes back on our own selves, right? That we're
destructive. I think also that, I mean, that's where the social anxiety of just being forces, mysterious forces beyond our control, which can be the economic crisis, which can, right, this kind of sense of being at the will of others, of not being able to have the kind of agency and you know, and choice that we believe we should have.
It's interesting. I was thinking when you were speaking earlier in the first segment, though, the specifics of the power dynamics have really been eroded in the post-1968 zombie, because you don't have the sense of the zombie being put to work by Bela Lugosi on a plantation. We don't know who, I mean, no one is con- controlling
right.
the zombies
right.
in
right.
Walking Dead or many of these zombies. They're just not in
They're
control
multiplying.
Of themselves.
Yeah, but you're starting to see more of that in some of the postmodern zombie literature. James Knapp's Silent Army, the film Fido, you're seeing the commodification of the zombie, and it's moved back into that space. And also at the same time, the zombie apocalypse can be seen as a really freeing sort of thing, because all of a sudden you can do whatever you have to do to survive. And the most gloriously over-the-top version of this video game, Dead Rising, you're in a shopping mall. And, you know, what was the site of terror and the ultimate critique in the early zombie films is now, you know, it's a golden corral of things to smite zombies with. And you can use anything and go into any store and take anything and do what you have to because, hey, zombies.
Do you choke them with it? Is that, what do you do with
well,
this?
Choking really doesn't work on dead people, I found. But,
well,
you know.
Well, you know, you can shoot them and they die. I can never figure
Helicopters
that out either.
Are always a favorite. They go back to 1968
well, you make
as well.
It effect. I mean, it was such a, that was such a great idea, the idea that there was a master, that somebody who administered, right, either
right.
The hex or the medicine and then brought you under their control. And then we lose that. There are these viruses that are just ambient viruses or they get out
Or sometimes
somehow.
Radio. From satellites returning from Venus. I mean, there really are, again, sort of historically specific fears that get expressed about how the zombies mm-hmm. are created. We certainly have the post-HIV AIDS era. It's, you know, the virus, outbreak, yeah. the contagion has really, you know, mm-hmm. infected the zombie tale.
I mean, there's at least one early film where it's basically to create an army, right? And I even think in The Lord of the Rings and some, you know, you kind of have that similar kind of feeling, right? That you kind of create armies of the dead for a purpose, though, for a specific purpose. Whereas in other forms, it's just a generalizable fear without a particular purpose or end.
And it's a fear, as Richard was talking about. I mean, it's a fear of the horde. I mean, mm-hmm, there's never right. one zombie. There's always you turn the corner and then there's
they
an army of zombies. So it's about our fear of other people and our fear of the large amounts of people that we interact with.
But it has changed over time. Again, if you have the zombie master, they're sort of having to do it one at a time. And then with the infection, there's the danger that we can just get this by being exposed either to what the initial virus or to a zombie who's been infected.
Mm-hmm. The hierarchical stuff seems to have really shifted over to the vampires.
Right.
You know, with
right.
Anne Rice, with the Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game, movies like Lost Boys, you know, there's the vampire master. And that's got that sort of formalized old world. Okay, there's one guy at the top, and then there's minions, and then there's minions below that. Zombies are chaos. Zombies are relentless. Zombies are faceless. And that's part of what's scary about them. There is no soft spot. There is no point you can concentrate your resistance.
And
that's right. And they're the plebes. You know, they're plebeian. Right. The vampires have really assumed the sort of aristocratic
yeah.
location
yeah.
in horror. And they really ruled in the 80s and the 90s primarily. There were zombie films and stories and games certainly being put out there. But vampires had sort of eclipsed them. And after 2000, it's, you know, it's zombies everywhere.
And
even in Jane Austen.
Great metaphors still in politics. Let's listen.
And Mitt Romney is a very different candidate. One with the vision and determination to cut through business-as-usual politics and finally put this country back on the path to the zombie apocalypse. Anyone who can run, fight, make explosives out of household objects, or especially do parkour of any kind, you'll want to stick with them.
Joss Whedon, who, of course, directed The Avengers, but also Buffy the Vampire Slayer, had that message, that political message. So it's an endlessly useful, endlessly useful image, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
one that's, as you say, quite malleable. That keeps. So what's the future of the zombie, since it's never going to die, I suppose?
Well, I think,
where are they headed?
Yeah, we're at this point, they are such a part of the cultural landscape. You know, they're in kids' games, you know, zombies, you know, Plants versus Zombies. They're in grown-up video games. They're in movies. They're in books. They're in young adult. They're everywhere. You know, they turned Spider-Man into a zombie for a while. And what I think that does actually gets us to an interesting place where it's such a part of the cultural terrain. Everybody knows the rules that you're going to start to see more and more interesting experimentation with what a zombie is. One example I'll throw out there is a short story by Real Ewers. I think it's called The Singing Bird and Other Stories in 21st Century Dead. And that takes the zombie trope and puts it in the Balkan conflicts and does some absolutely heartbreaking things with it. And the last thing you expect from a zombie story is for it to be a heartbreaker. But he pulls it off because the ground is already set. He doesn't have to waste time on the setup and he can get really to the meat of his story.
Mm-hmm. I've been interested in just one thing in the recent Walking Dead and thinking about the zombie is that they're also a metaphor for migrating populations, right? They never settle. It's the uninfected people who settle and build up the barricades, and the zombies are destined to wander.
They will be with us forever.
And I would, I mean, I think that as the conditions that gave rise to the mythology, which is certain forms of alienation, you know, of power, you know, they're going to be with us for a while too. And as long as they are, I think it'll be a form through which people try to address them.
What a great pleasure. Thank you all for being on the program today. Lorraine Dubois, professor of history and romance studies at Duke, co-director of Haiti Lab at Duke's Franklin Humanities Institute. Maria Promajori is head of North Carolina State's film studies program. And Richard Dansky is a game writer for Ubisoft. He is also a horror novelist. Just ahead, we're going to talk with Beverly Guy Scheftel about the evolution of black feminism. Stay with us on The State of Things.